Hello, everyone. Welcome to the TeamCast. I am Dr. Preston Klein, Director of Research and Education at the Mission Critical Team Institute. The TeamCast is a show where my colleagues discuss all things mission critical teams. Mission critical teams are teams of 4 to 12 people who are indigenously trained and educated and who solve rapidly emerging complex adaptive problem sets. MCTs work in immersive environments of 300 seconds or less where the consequence of failure is death or catastrophic loss. Regardless of whether you are a mission critical team or not, we aim to bring you the broadest range of topics and guests as possible. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you enjoy the TeamCast.
Our guest today is Sean Griffiths. Sean is an emergency physician that did his training and early attending time at the United States Air Force at Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas. He's currently in the Air National Guard, and he describes his educational passions as resident education through preparedness and mindful feedback on the rigors of military and civilian expectations of emergency physicians. Now, I'm not exactly sure how we met, but it was somewhere in the universe of online stuff of people talking about things, which is very descriptive. But over the last chunk of time, I've come to know Sean as a really deep thinker on emergency medical training, on what it takes to prepare folks to operate in really high stakes moments, and on the gap between and synergy between performing in emergency medicine in civilian and military worlds. So I think there's going to be a ton to talk about today. Sean, thank you for coming on the podcast. It's an honor to have you.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited.
Yeah. Can you break down for us a little bit about what you spend your days doing these days and what's that look like?
Yeah. So I'm just a regular ER doc. Like a lot of people, I work in the community in Texas at big ERs, small ERs, standalones. And then I also do a fair amount of time at a level one trauma center at Brooke Army Medical Center. Now that I'm off my active duty time, I work there as a contractor. And then I do time with the residents, sort of off hours for resident education and kind of enhancing their skills somewhat through that. So I basically do what a lot of the other ER docs listening on here does, a mix of just different clinical practices.
Yeah. So that's actually a really interesting thing to push on, because we haven't talked about that in a little while or really deeply in any meaningful way in a long time on the podcast, which is that these different practice environments are really wildly different. And so one of the requirements for the emergency doctor pipeline in the States is that you produce somebody at the end of this training who's capable of operating in a wide variety of different circumstances which are really fundamentally different from each other, right? So you mentioned a couple of them, right? A level one trauma center all the way to standalone ERs. Can you talk us through some of the differences between those shops in terms of like what your job is and how that, and eventually we're going to hook this back into how do you train people to operate in those environments?
For sure. So I think for me, like when I go to the level one trauma center, I know I'm going to see really sick people and I know I'm going to be challenged, but I also know that like resource-wise, it's the easiest place I work. There's the sickest people there, sure, but I have the most friends. I have the most hands helping me. I have the most stuff. I have the most people dedicated to the care of these patients. I have the most skilled nursing staff and things like that. When I go somewhere else, the sick patients, they can't delineate what's a big hospital, what's a small hospital. They just go to the one that's near them. And so when I work at some of these smaller places, I almost feel like your skills are a little bit more challenged because you're doing, I won't say more with less, you're expected to do the same with less. And that basically falls onto the physician, I think, because you cannot multiply the amount of nurses you have, you can't multiply the amount of blood products you have, you can't multiply the amount of rapid infusers or whatever. It's just you there. There is no trauma surgeon, there is no anesthesia, just call in and help you. And so I think when you work at some of the further out sites, it doesn't mean that the acuity necessarily gets less. And then certainly when it comes to freestanding work, freestanding can be a nice, easy day, but can also be, you know, one of the worst days if a sick person happens to roll in because it says emergency over the door and we have to be ready and we can't fool ourselves or be sort of lulled into a false sense of security that says only people with sniffles come here. I've seen people stabbed in the chest that come into freestanding ERs. And so, you know, it's not exactly they didn't know that it wasn't a real hospital. So I think you just have to be that constant vigilance is something that either you learn through experience or you do have to be trained on to say like, hey, no matter where I'm going, I'm going to have to be ready when I get there.
I'm fairly certain that's the first time the word sniffles has appeared on this podcast. So
there you go.
We're getting to the meat of the matter right away.
Yeah. Exactly.
How was that like when you started doing that? I imagine you've changed your own personal method for working in these different places, right? Because I think you're right. Now, I say this perhaps reflecting on my own experience working in some of these different environments, that there's a... it's not just the tools you have. It's also the types of teams that are around you, the mindset, the training patterns, the ethos and culture of the places that are really different, right? So even though both types of places are set up to and have to be ready for a cardiac arrest or a gunshot wound or a traffic victim or a choking, you know, patient or whatever it is, the reality of executing on those plans is very different in those spaces. So take that any way you want. What did it start like? What is it like now? What changed for you? How's that working?
Yeah, for sure. I think I maybe had maybe the most stark realization of like where I trained and where I'm headed to are different places when I graduated residency. And then I went on deployment like in the first 6 months after residency. And I got to a place that, you know, it was just like a tent that had really nothing. And, you know, you go there and you came from a place when you're surrounded by your peers, your own residents, other attendings, and you're in like a highly motivated population of people. Most people in the United States military are also highly motivated, but not every single person wants to be on deployment. Not everybody wants to go there. And so how do you lead people who aren't necessarily interested in getting on board with the plan? And the same thing happens, I think, when you go to some of these smaller rural ERs and traumas come in and you're used to working in a multidisciplinary trauma team, and then you are the entirety of the trauma team, you and one person. So I think I learned a lot about having to lead people who are not used to being led. And at first I did that quite badly, I think, which was just saying like, well, you have to work harder and you have to be better and we have to do these things. And then I think I learned over time, realizing like everybody has their own unique skill sets. How do I amplify those instead of just highlight what's wrong with them? Like, what do you mean you don't know how to do this? Like, this is the standard of care or whatever. And that was a ridiculous way to talk to people and approach people. And I probably didn't make too many friends that way. And then I realized, you know, later as that was ineffective, how do I, each individual person wants to be led differently. For me, a kick in the butt was pretty good when I was growing up and when I was in residency, but not everybody wants to learn that way. And so I think realizing, getting into everybody's strengths and figuring out what motivates them and getting them to more towards what you think the resuscitation should look like or what their preparation should be is really valuable. And that does at times come into conflict with what they're used to. And so just addressing that from a sense of like, I'm not doing it for me. I'm doing it because the patients need it. And most people are okay with that kind of mentality.
I think you find almost this sort of like barbell pattern in emergency medicine where the culture and ethos and drive of the folks that are working in the ultra high end places, BAMC or wherever, is usually really high. Like people don't show up there on accident. They work there because they want to be there. Mm-hmm. And then you almost see the same thing all the way on the other end. The really, really, really tiny shops, especially if they're mission driven, they're Indian Health Service or they're critical access hospitals or something, right? In those really small places, a lot of times people are there because they want to be there, because they want to operate in those circumstances. Mm-hmm. Not always, but a lot of the time. And then there's sort of this like middle ground where there's not quite as clear of a mission, and sometimes it's a little bit harder to figure out. But there's a couple of things that are worth poking out of that. And then, by the way, if you're listening to this and you're in a level one trauma center, or you're listening to this and you're in a level four trauma center or a non-type trauma center, or you're in the middle of nowhere, like, we love you. We're not judging you, right? We just want you to, we want all of us to be better at what we're doing. And we're just trying to figure out the themes that come out of this. So one thing is there's just, because there are just so many fewer people in some of these smaller places, the individual impact of each person on the culture of the team can swing much heavier, right? Like you're just getting much larger effects. So part of your job as the leader in that space is really to learn much more the people around you and their skill sets in a way that you almost don't have to as much when you're operating in the really big spaces. Not that you don't need to learn your teammates, because you do, but the effect size of an individual relationship as part of that whole interwoven web and culture is very different. The other thing that's worth pointing out is that, like, there's so much wisdom in the way you just described your job right there, which is that it's not enough to know the medical standard of care and to execute on it and to know the trauma protocols and everything. You actually have to go out and realize that your job is to understand the motivation patterns and the ways that people receive from all of your teammates who you didn't know before, you don't know who they are, you don't necessarily come from the same places or train in the same ways. Somehow that's also your job to do that. And I think we're starting to lean into that more and more in emergency medicine, but I still think we have a long way to go to figure out how, like, how that works and how to teach that.
For sure. I think, I don't think physicians necessarily realize how different they are from other people on the planet. Mm-hmm. And so when you're in the rigors of residency, you know, at least where I trained at, it's such a grind. It's such a beat down. It's such an acid washing of your like humility. And so you just realize like, okay, I'm wrong all the time and that's fine. I don't care if I'm wrong and I'll just keep pushing to the end of this training pipeline and eventually I'll come out as an emergency physician. But I just ran headlong into that when I was deployed doing this training course that I ran for medics. And we did all this simulation and we brought the dogs in and we did dog training and we did this like super big contest across the whole base and all these things and nighttime exercises and blah, 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 blah. And I had medics, like a couple of them, they just like didn't want to do it. And I just couldn't understand why someone, what do you mean you don't want to get better? We're out here all alone. We're just in a tent. Something bad could happen and we're all we have, like no one's coming to save us. And then it finally, you know, after many, many, many attempts at bad leadership, I sort of found out they were just worried about being embarrassed in front of their friends. And that's like such a simple fix. But it had been so long since I like had enough confidence to be embarrassed in front of my friends because I was like wrong all the time in residency, you know? It had been so long that since that had happened that I didn't even think about that as a problem. I had just thought, okay, well, like, who cares if you're wrong? Like, now you just won't make that mistake again. With other people, that was still a big part of them. And so just realizing that, like, you think everyone's like you, but no one thinks like you. And so you can't just approach them in the way that you would want to be taught. And it took me a long time with residents to figure that out too. I was just teaching them how I thought I wanted to teach them. And then sure, I realized like, oh, this person doesn't work for them.
Yeah. You talk about the I love that phrase, the acid washing of humility. It sort of acid washes your soul while it's at it, right? But
yeah.
I have this very strong memory of being an intern and reporting to one of the senior doctors about this patient and pointing to this spot on the side of their body and being like, yeah, they have flank pain over here or something. And getting just the most intense dressing down because apparently that wasn't the flank. Apparently that was part of the abdomen. And I just, you know, I left that being like, my God, I don't know my ass from my elbow. Right? Like, yeah. I don't know if that's my side or my front. Oh, wow. Like, right. I don't know my side or my front. How do I, you know, and you just sort of like stew on it. And then over the years, then there's this phase where I'm like, no, that's the side. I know what the side of the body is. That's the side. And then you keep going. And then at some point you realize like, it actually that wasn't the point. It doesn't matter. Like the point is that like, I was thinking about it wrong. And like, I should have been casting a broader understanding of like that and people's physiology doesn't match textbooks and you have to treat the reality of the patient right in front of you, not the theory and blah, blah, blah. There was actually a really deep lesson in there, which was delivered with a slap in the face as opposed to perhaps a slightly more thoughtful sort of approach to it. But you know, that is such a fundamental part of our upbringing. And that way that you're describing about thinking now ahead about how is this other person, what are they motivated by? What's going to take it to get them to the next level? Like, what is it that they care about? What are they afraid of? What's like, what is a vector that I can use to get this knowledge towards them, but also to learn what they know and teach me on the same side of it? What's that look like for you now? How do you do that? Do you have like a way you approach a new person? You know, you show up at shift tomorrow and it's a brand new person there with you. How do you do that?
Yeah, I got a reputation at Bansi for giving what was considered really good feedback, but also kind of direct feedback over time. Because, you know, I was like the resident who they just said, oh, good job, you know, keep reading. And I know I'm a moron. I know there's things I could be better at. So I felt like you only have a few hundred shifts and then you could be out somewhere in the middle of nowhere in war or whatever. And so I feel like I owed it to them to give them feedback every shift. And so if I work with a new person or someone I haven't worked with that much, because we have a lot of staff there, you don't get with the same resident all the time. I basically just tell them like, hey, I will never cheat you. I will never shortchange you. I will give you feedback every day. And I do it to make you better. It's way easier for me to say, good job, keep reading. But I won't cheat you because I won't cheat your future patients. And so like, I will teach today. Sometimes I got to get warmed up. It takes me like an hour sometimes to get into it. But like, totally. I will be doing teaching today. And so I basically preemptively tell them, like, they're going to get feedback, and they're going to get feedback to make them better, not only on feedback on things that they did good at, but I definitely make an effort to specifically discuss things that they did good that day. I used to just like, you sucked at this and you were dog shit at that. And you know, we need to do better. I used to just do that, which is bad. But now I specifically tell them that they're going to get feedback and that I'm doing it because I won't cheat them out of the day. And then I will specifically make time to give excellent feedback. And I try to give, I specifically try to almost give like character feedback on good things, like things about them personally that they did good, instead of just like, good job on the central line. My wife's not medical. Give me 2 hours. I can give her how to teach her how to do a central line. And that would not be that big a deal. But I think what's much more profound thing to witness is a resident whispering in the ear of a trauma patient that's critically ill, holding their hand. I saw a resident once while they were putting a central line in, put their phone on the bed and put classical music on so the patient could listen to it while they got an IJ placed. And so those things, I try to notice those things about the actual resident themselves or the people that I'm working with, not just like the technician things that they did good.
Yeah, that's so good. I think there's a huge lever in there too for making the hidden more visible. And whether that's like, hey, that was a really good, you know, successful central line placement. Can you tell me why you think that went well? Right? What were you thinking about it that made you make this decision? Or, you know, it's interesting. We went this way. That seemed to work really well. That's awesome. What were some other stuff that, what would have made you go in a different direction? Or to borrow from one of my prior guests, Kevin Sear, to tell me the things you thought about doing and didn't do and why. Right? Yeah, right. Yeah, he's awesome. Kevin, if you're listening to this, you're awesome. Those sort of lateral moves, I think, are huge ways to get to really increase that feedback and also to help people work on the skill of self-reflection and self-analysis. Because I think one of the other differences about operating in some of these small places is that not only are you alone, but there is nobody watching what you're doing and feeding back to you, right? So you have to do the thing, and then you also have to figure out how to get better at the thing. And so that sense of, hey, I'm going to do a pretty critical analysis of what just happened and talk it through, like, is also part of your skill that you have to train. You know, there's two directions that we can go from here, and I'm open to either one that you want to go to, right? So one is we can talk through some of the work that you've been doing around getting folks ready for these super hard days, like when they're out in the universe. And the other is that we can talk about the sort of bombshell quote that you left on a feedback form that for something we did about how we should change the way that mission critical is operating. And I'm happy to go in either of those directions. I don't know if you have a preference. Otherwise, I'll just pick one.
I'll let you pick one. I don't know if I have the solution to the bombshell quote, but
well, great. We're going to do that one, then, and we'll figure that out together. So the context for this is honestly not super relevant. We were talking about a training set that we were going to do and how it was going to happen and who was going to be there and whatnot. And at the end of this feedback form was something like, anything else? ? And I didn't really expect anybody to put anything in there. And Sean, true to his form about leading feedback, left this burning quote about, hey, there's all these people that are dying unnecessarily because they're showing up to small shops and the people there are trying their best, but they don't have the same access to team training and to the ability to operate under pressure as the folks at the really large places do. And what are we going to do about that? I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but I liked the way that you threw that out there and then left it as basically like, okay, all right, now what, Dan? What are you going to do about it?
Well, yeah, what are you and MCTI going to do about it? Yeah, no, that's true. I just feel that like down to my bones, you know, because I work at these other, I work at the big white hospital on the hill, and then I work in the smaller places too. And I do see that it's not really like a talent variation. Like there are talented people everywhere, but they just don't have the reps and the I believe this down in my bones too. Like, all problems are leadership problems. Like, they don't necessarily have the leadership there to instill the lessons that they need to learn. And I'm combating this same problem with my own career, like in guard. And I'm trying to get guard medics to a level that, you know, is capable of taking care of combat wounded. And so, yeah, it's a real problem, because I think there's no easy solutions that are identifiable.
Sure. Let's build some anyway. Right. Yeah. So let's pretend for a minute that there is a brand new level 4 trauma center that drops into place near your area. Right. And if you're listening to this and you're not medical, I want to wrap a little context around this so you understand this next part of what we're talking about. Level 4 trauma centers are smaller hospitals, usually critical access hospitals, that have the capacity to take in a trauma victim when they come in. Now, that capacity, it can be a little bit different, right? So, for example, you might be talking about a hospital that is 6 to 10 ER beds, maybe less, one ER doctor, a general surgeon, probably not a trauma surgeon, a general surgeon that's somewhere nearby and can get to the hospital within an hour or something. Maybe you have some blood products, maybe you don't. Maybe you have anesthesia, maybe you don't. And there's a whole host of things like that depending on the day. So you could be the only doctor in the hospital when this patient comes in, or you could be a doctor and there's some other people and there's clinic. But everybody there at least has gone through some training. So you have nurses and techs who've gone through something. But that's sort of the rough context of this. So, okay, so there's this brand new hospital. What do you want to call it? Do you have a name for your new hospital?
I don't know. No.
Okay. All right.
Hospital X.
Yeah. Hospital X it is. Great. Okay. The Hospital X it is. All right. That was your chance, man. You could have named it anything.
I know.
Yeah. All right. That's okay. Hospital X it is. It's a great name. Hospital X. It's got a great logo. They paid some consultant, you know, it's got an X with a hospital logo on it, whatever. So Hospital X drops down next to you and they say, Sean, you're now in charge. It's your job to handle the emergency and trauma systems of this hospital. We'll make sure you have some doctors and nurses that show up and some other people that are here and all of the basics and the lights are on and stuff. But it's really going to be up to you to build it. So what do you do? Where do you start? What do you assemble? What do you want to tackle?
I think one of the hardest but most fundamental things is probably like getting people to believe that they are, I hate the term provider, but like that they are providers of critical care, to get them to believe that. So many people at some places, well, I'm just, you know, I do sepsis and I do ankle fracture and I do whatever, but the sick people, they go to other places. Other people, more skilled people, better people, people other than me take care of the really sick. I think building a culture where you get people to believe that they are taker carers of sick people, essentially, that they one day could take care of a sick person, and building that culture from the ground up, not saying we may have less, but we personally are not less than. Some of that, I think, goes into the second thing, which would be you need to show people what right looks like. If you've never seen someone like who's been shot, the idea that someone is like shot in an ER somewhere and like someone's saving them, that's like a foreign concept to you. Like, yeah, I'm sure I've seen it on TV and I've seen it on the pit, but like it's never going to happen to me. But suddenly if you're within 20 feet of that person, that now becomes very real. And so can you get every single nurse and doc and tech who's going to work in a level 4 trauma center to go take trauma call at a level 1? No, but you can definitely get them there to see it, and to see what it looks like, and to see what right looks like. If you can see it in its most pristine form with the large team, you can scale that down. But it's difficult to start with a tiny team with less resources and then perform at a high level. It's easier to parse down than build up, I think. And so I think those two things, like getting them to believe that they're capable of great things. I mean, especially in trauma, like trauma is like so simple, relatively speaking, compared to some other medical things that like even faraway places should be able to perform damage control resuscitation on trauma patients, like at a really high level. Like that is something that does drive me crazy, that San Antonio has a very progressive EMS system and they have been using whole blood for a long period of time now. People should not be getting a higher standard of care in the back of a freaking ambulance than they should be at their local small hospital. Like that's insanity. And so people who work at those places should believe that they can take care of sick people. And then if they go to the trauma centers, they should be able to see what right looks like. So it's not a myth. It's not this mythical thing. It's something that can be done. These people who work at the big trauma centers, they are real people. So getting them to believe it and then getting them to see it with their own eyes is a good start.
There's this sense in there of something you said earlier, which is that there's nobody coming to save us. It's up to us. Like, we are the ones who are going to do it. And having that mental switch in there, I remember very vividly the first time that I was in a room where a patient went into cardiac arrest and reaching out for the other like medical team and then realizing, wait a minute, actually, like, I need to start CPR on this person right now.
Yeah.
And like, wait a minute, this is me. And you know, you have to go through some version of that, right? Like, you have to be able to find folks that step towards the problem and try to solve it, right? As like a fundamental piece of their identity in those spaces. And I think that's challenging because, you know, to link back to some of your other stories, like, not everybody wants that. Not everybody wants to do that. For the folks that do, so maybe there's some buckets in there, right? Maybe there's folks that don't want to do it, but they'll try it. Maybe there's folks that want to do it, but are scared of doing it or scared of being embarrassed or scared of failing or whatever. And then there's the folks that want to do it that think it's their, you know, their sort of bread and butter. That's why we're here for it. So you have to take that mix of people and probably some other folks that I didn't mention and help them see themselves as this group that's going to operate together, that's going to step forward and try to do it. Okay. How do you do that?
Yeah. I think, like I said before, nope, every problem is a leadership problem. And I think it'd be very difficult for a locums doc day one to walk into a new shop and be like, hey, everybody, here's a sick person. I'm going to lead you all. And that team have confidence in them, right? There are some things you can definitely do to lose confidence in people. But I think some of it does just take time in those leaders. This sounds like so cliche, but like leaders getting to know their people and letting your people know that you care about them and that you are doing teaching and you're trying to help in a way that is moving everybody towards a greater success. And so I think building that trust is the same way you would build trust with a friend, a new friend. I really don't think it's any different than that. That sounds like lame and that sounds like not very scientific, but like, I think, and I've just started to believe this more as I've gotten just a little bit older, but physicians, they want to science everything. They want to make everything a number and they want to make everything a graph, which I have like some form of dyslexia or something. I can't read graphs, but like, we sort of forget like the humanity part of like being a physician and the ability to like connect with other people, not just patients, but like the people that we work with and say like, hey, you may not be a leader at heart, but like as the physician, I know I have to lead. And so I will lead you. There will be natural leaders who are, you know, medics in the ED, techs, nurses, whatever. There's natural leaders throughout at all ranges of skill level. But as a physician, you have to lead. But most people do, like they will follow for sure. And they'll gain confidence from a leader. So I think sometimes not everything has to be documented or quantified, but there's that phrase from Legacy by James Kerr that says, better people make better all blacks. And it's like, I'm working on something for BAMC residents that's like, you know, better people make better war doctors. And like, you could apply that to the rest of medicine as well and other business leadership. Like, being a good person goes really far in being a good leader. And being a good person just makes your other teammates better.
I was working today on a couple of projects through Mission Critical, and one of the things we were talking about was a concept of thriving providers in thriving communities fed by thriving systems, right? And that the opposite of burnout is this sort of concept of, we're going to take good people, we're going to support them in good teams, and we're going to teach them how to be part of good teams. And then we're going to build systems around them that make success more likely to happen. And in a way, that's sort of what you're describing, right? You want to start with a really good human being, a good high quality human being, right? And then bring them into a team and teach them how to be part of a team. And you're right that this isn't, the answer to this is not going to be a double blinded placebo controlled trial of saying good things to each other or saying bad things to each other, right? Like, this is going to be like normal humanity and like hardcore teamwork that makes this stuff happen. It's just that the fault lines of all that get exposed so much more when there's blood and screaming and chaos and everything else that we go through. So you really have to have the basics sort of put together for that to work.
It's complicated. It's complicated to mass produce. I think the military talks about that with special operations, that one of the tenets of SOF is SOF operators cannot be mass produced. And if anybody is a special talent in a community, it's the people that save their fellow citizens. Like, I can't think of a more virtuous job in the world. And I think some of it comes back to like how physicians, I think, view themselves. I think I'm a Kool-Aid drinker, right? Like, if I'm in something, like, I'm really in it. Like, I can't be partially in it. I heard a phrase, I think it's like the Recon Marine phrase or something for their selection. And it says, all it takes is everything you got. And I think physicians would like do well to remember that and like remember where they're at in life and in society and just double down on this job is about helping people and not just about making money and not just about like nice cars and nice vacations. And I like all that stuff too, trust me. But I think the thriving person, thriving hospital, thriving system thing, that only exists if people are all in. I'm not saying everybody has to go like interview to be the medical director at their next shop, but just try to make every day like the best you can and try to teach somebody something every day. And then eventually you get enough of that happening. Suddenly, like, you have 25 great people that work in the same ER. And it seems like it's by accident, but it maybe only started with a few good people working there.
Yeah. So, and maybe that's a great direction to push this, because let's connect a couple of these dots, right? You said earlier, we may have less, but we are not less than, right? As like this ethos of these smaller shops. And the way you're describing this now is like, you have this ability to make decisions on a small scale, on a shift by shift basis, on a case by case or whatever, that have these ripples through the culture of the community that you work at. And let's say you're listening to this and you're not the physician, you're not the team leader, you're somebody who works at one of these hospitals and you wake up and you want to do a better job tomorrow than you did yesterday. How do you do that when you're not in charge?
Yeah, I think being open to change is probably a good place to start. You know, I've experienced some change in my career recently, and some have been good and some of them have been bad, but like improvement is changing. And so you have to be open to changing if you're going to improve. And so I think being, if you're not in one of those leadership roles or those like sort of key decision maker roles, being able to change something that you're doing in terms of like even small stuff, you know, attitude on shift, ability to listen to other people, and ability to just help out your teammates. I think that's a big one. So yeah, the being open to change, I think, is a big one to start with. Because so it's easy to say no. It's way easier to say no than to say, yeah, sure, I'll like do extra work. Yeah, sure, I'll get in on this like Zoom call on a hospital committee or whatever. Like, nobody wants to do that. But the only people doing those things are people trying to do better.
Yeah, or I'll try to, you know, join in this new system, or I'll, you know, ask questions at the time when there's space, or I'll throw scenarios at each other and, you know, sort of take that downtime and not play Candy Crush and instead sort of really try to make the team around you better as you're doing it. We had, I forget when I picked this up in residency, but it was really, you know, you talk about that ethos of like, you only have a few hundred shifts until you're out there alone. We didn't say it like that. And I wish I'd heard it like that, because I think that's actually really, really powerful message, right? But we did hear the message that, you know, basically every shift you work, you have a choice if the shop will be better or worse at the end of it for you being there.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a choice you make every single shift with your actions and your choices. And that boils down to all of the small moments. Sometimes we talk about it from like the leave no trace camping principles, right? Which is a little bit weird to loop in there, but it's like, you should leave the campground better than you found it. You should leave the ER better than you found it at that shift in some way, whatever it is. And that translates down into like that patient, if you can, or that room or that something, right? So like, you should be picking up the stuff and throwing it away, or fixing the squeaky door, or whatever it is, just making the shop better than it was when you first got there. And I think that is doable whether you are a long-term permanent fixture in a shop, or you're a locum doctor or a travel nurse, or you're passing through, right? Like, you have those options every shift to make the space and the people around you better for it. And maybe that's kind of like the second pillar of what we're hitting for this, right? So we hit this first pillar, which is like, I believe that I can make a difference, right? That there's nobody coming, that I'm one of the people that's going to step forward and try to fix problems. And I believe that the choices that I make have meaningful impact into my culture and my community. And so I'm going to choose carefully how to make this place better when I leave it than when I start in there.
Exactly.
We're making sort of the code of ethics for Hospital X here, right? You thought I forgot about that, but I didn't.
Yeah.
What else would you put on that, right? If you're recruiting people, right, you're thinking about, we have this idea that we're going to bring good people in to work at this hospital, and then we're going to help them get better, right? So we want people that step forward. We want people that believe that they can make a difference and make choices that make a difference. What else is on that hit list?
I've moaned about this for a long time, and I'm probably just going to muddy the water more and make it complicated. But I think it does go into how you select people. This is it's easier to say than do, certainly. But this is back to, I think, how we initially met. I was becoming very interested in resident selection, and how I was a courtship director at one point. I ran academics and stuff, and I was very interested in how we were selecting people, which was basically, you're coming to a training course that's 3 years. You don't know how to do this, so we're going to teach you the skills. And then instead of selecting for quote unquote good people, instead of selecting for character, because we're already teaching skills, we were selecting for different skills. Where did you go to school and what did you get on this test? How good are you at doing laceration repair? And then expecting that person at the end of a 3-year curriculum to have good character. And I was more interested in like, how can we select people for character and then train the skills? I mean, that's what these highly effective teams do, right? Like that's what Special Operations does. That's what the Navy SEALs do. They put you to these terrible things that don't teach you anything for the most part. And then once you're selected for theoretically good character, not always, but theoretically, then they teach you the skills. And so I think getting an interview and selection process for people to work at your place that at least attempts to select for character by using a grit scale or using some of these team-based interviews where you see how people actually work together, instead of just saying like, oh, you went to, you know, this nursing school and you have a, you know, whatever GPA, like that's great. You must be like a great person to work with. It's like, well, I mean, maybe, maybe not. You went to Harvard Medical School and you went to the greatest residency in the world. You must be a great doctor. Maybe or maybe not, but using some kind of selection process that assesses for character, I think would do really well in weeding out people who may be the crabs that pull people down to the bucket, you know, when we are trying to institute change.
Yeah, that is a real challenge. I don't know of many places in the medical world that run selection that way. You know, there's some version of that test, right? Sometimes in ER, it's called the 3 a.m. test, right? Like,
yes, for sure.
Would you want, you know, it's 3 a.m. It's a hard shift. You turn the corner and this is who you see coming the other direction. Are you happy about that? Is this a thing where you're like, yeah, this person will throw their shoulder in and pull their weight and make me laugh and keep me above water and like, you know, rescue me when I'm drowning and everything. And shorthanded in this, but it's sort of like convoluted with, do you like them? Which is like a different, in some ways, like a different sort of thing, right?
Because it blurs into like, that's a tough one.
Yeah. Because it blurs into like, are they like you? Right. Which I think can be a dangerous thing to select on, right? If we're only selecting people that are like us, then we run a lot of risks in there.
Very much so. I think emergency medicine gets very clicky about that. By the way, particularly emergency medicine, I think, oh, does this person rock climb and do they, you know, drive a sports car? Do they surf? Do they like do some of these, you know, stereotypical emergency medicine things, or are they like just somewhat different? And then if they're different, they're not like us, we can't like them. And so I think, determining that 3 a.m. test versus whether you like them, those should need to be separated.
My partner ended up in the ER for something not too long ago. She's totally fine. And it wasn't a place where I was working. And the doctor that was there, she comes home and is like, this guy was also named Dan, and he had your same haircut, and he had the same shoes that you do. made a joke that I'm pretty sure that you would make, and I'm really confused about it. And I was like, oh yeah, I mean, I probably know the guy, right? Like, I don't know the guy, but like, I think you're right that we run the risk of over-indexing on what we're comfortable with, which is a different question than what character looks like. And it's just, you know, you think about it from the Kahneman and Tversky systems of like we're substituting an easier question, right? It's really hard to find character. We're substituting an easier question, which is, do I feel comfortable next to this person? And they're not unrelated questions, but they're not the same question.
Yes. It's the same, you know, when you get to resident evaluations, sometimes you get residents that come to later in their training and you're like, man, this is a good dude. And then you just work with them and you're like, you're not that good on shift. And you have to address those specifically and say, like, I have to separate the skill evaluation from, you know, your personal feelings about that person too. And so it is a continuing thing to develop that. And I think it's hard to scale and mass, but I think like we make the most impact on our daily life by decisions that affect us on a day-to-day basis. And so like the people that you work around, like some of the places where I work, I love going there because the people are great, even if, you know, the hospitals, you know, went away and you know, maybe the patient population isn't the best. And, you know, maybe it's very, very busy even, you know, if you work super hard, but the people there, they've struck gold for some reason and just found that core group. And it really doesn't, you know, one bad apple spoils the bunch, but like, you know, it only takes three or four good people to make a place good as well. So I don't think the problems are insurmountable. Everybody's been part of a good team before. And, you know, they're always looking for that. And so I think it's easy to at least identify when you have a good team.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I love that optimistic view of it, of like, it only takes a few good people to really start making a core of difference in the space, and like little decisions by multiple people adding up over time and compounding to make a really strong cultural difference in there.
Oh yeah. I mean, everybody knows. I'll just use an example from my personal work, and you won't care that I'm mentioning it. There's a nurse who works at BAMC. His name is John Luna, and he's a nurse. He's an RN, but everybody calls him Dr. Luna. And the reason is because he's one of the best nurses I've ever worked with in my whole career. And if something bad's going to happen, you say, where's Luna at? And you just go find, he usually finds you first, because even if he's 25 rooms away, he'll come over and find the sick people. And so everybody has, you know, a Dr. Luna in their ED or their office, the person that you go to who isn't in charge, that gets everything done and knows everybody and is great to work with. Find those people and eventually you'll find good leaders, and eventually the whole team will be uplifting. But yeah, everybody has somebody who works with them that isn't in charge. That's the go-to person.
Love it. So we've covered a lot of ground in this, right? We talked through this idea of building a fake hospital and what it takes to really create a culture and a system that operates under pressure. We talked a little about selection. We talked about character. What have we not talked about? And I guess I'd also ask that as like, feel free to sub in something that you want to talk about on a podcast, but also like, what are you wondering about? What question is like keeping you up at night as you think about this stuff?
Yeah. Ooh, that's deep. Somebody asked me, is like a guy who's going to go to med school. And he asked me, what's like your biggest fear? The other day when I was at work, it's like a particularly slow day. And I said, feeling like my life has no meaning. And he was like, well, what do you do about that? And I said, I come to work every day and I do the best that I can. And I think that's something that I think about a lot, which is like, not necessarily that every day is going to be a home run. Like that's certainly not realistic. But I'll be 36 in May. And so I'm young. I'm really in my career. Well, a little less than, you know, halfway done with my life. And so what can I do in these next 25 years of good work that I have in me to like really make the world as good as I can? Just because like I've done the thing where you work a lot and you make a lot of money. And I've done the thing where you don't work that much and you don't make money and you try to have fun. Both of them are fine, but neither of them necessarily have value in and of themselves. Like your bank account goes up, you're not any happier. Your bank account goes down, you're the same level of happy. And so what gives me good purpose? And I think helping the people who take care of sick people be better, that's probably the most valuable thing to me. And so I think getting people to buy into that for their whole careers, like, really can multiply, just selfishly, like multiply my effect on the earth, because I do worry like that I have this, we do this like critical thinking thing at BAMC with the residents called Resuscitation from Hell, where we take these really bad cases and we talk it over with residents. And one of them is a mass casualty incident. And I basically have all these newspaper clippings of Brooke Army Medical Center alumni that have participated in mass casualty incidents within just a few short years or less than graduating residency. And I'm putting that out there and saying, hey, this could be you one day. What are you going to do to make yourself or other people ready? And so that's very tangible for them because they're in the military. But I think like that doesn't have to be military only.
Sure.
That's like everybody, right? Like, you know, my wife's not medical. My wife stays home and takes care of our kids. Like, but she has a greater effect on our community probably than I do, because we can't go to the grocery store without seeing 25 people that she knows that love her. Yeah. And think she's a great person. And so every single person in the world can like make an impact on their community just by being as good as they can be. So I think about that a lot more than medicine. I think about, better doctors, better people make better doctors. And so how can you get there?
John, just hell yeah, man. Thank you for sharing that. It's just epic. That, like, I love it. I love it.
It's hard. It's easier just to study and not worry about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's true, right? Nothing about that's easy, but that's not the point. The point's not easy, right? The point is to make a difference and to have meaning with the time that you have. Yeah.
A resident asked me about that, and I said, we're just like floating around on this like speck of water, like around the fireball. Like, why are we doing that? It's not so I can drive a nice truck. Like, that's not it. I like my truck, but it can't be it.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Amazing. John, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and digging into all of this with us and for this uplifting message to end on like this. I want to give you a chance, as we always do, to end with a challenge. Although I think there's an enormous challenge in what you just said. So feel free to double down on it or pick something different. Anything you want folks listening to do differently or better. And as you're setting up for that, I'll put my disclaimer in there for all of us, which is that our job here on the podcast is to figure out the best of what other people have already learned about performing under pressure and being our best when it matters the most. We don't provide medical advice, and our views or anything we say are our own and not that of anybody that we work with or work for.
Yeah. I would say the challenge I have to people is something that I included in a lecture that I'm working on now. It's the acceptance that the responsibility of leadership is yours. And so like, sometimes it's very obvious who's the leader, but the reality of it is anybody can be a leader. They just have to accept that. And so, you know, there's lots of books on that, but I think the reality that you need to accept, no matter if you're the CEO, if you're a mid-level person or a low-level person, the ability to do your best every day is just something that you need to say yes to and just keep saying yes to every day. And yeah, I would challenge people to just do that. Don't get through the day. Be successful at the day. And not every day is going to be a win, but that's something that I try to think about on most days. And so I would challenge everybody to think about that when they go to work. Be good, right, like be good on purpose, not by accident.
Right on, man. John, thank you so much.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you again for listening to our Teamcast. For more information about the Mission Critical Team Institute, please go to www.missioncti.com or follow us on LinkedIn or Instagram. If you are a Mission Critical Team that wants more information on our courses, please reach out to our Director of Operations, Janice Jackson, at janice@missionCTI.com. That's J-A-N-E-S-E at missionCTI.com. And once again, thank you, Janice, and thank you to Shelby Rowe Productions for helping us produce the Teamcast. Have a great day.